I'm listening.
There's truth, and there's lies, and everything.
And I'm here to tell you what's the truth and lies.
You ready?
Welcome to Madman Bonus Features, a podcast series from Madman Entertainment, giving you an inside look into the making of some of the amazing films from our catalogue, featuring discussions and interviews with the artists and creatives behind them. We'd like to first acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast was produced, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, and pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. In this episode, we sit down with director Andrew Patterson to discuss his new film, The Rivals of Amziah King. Deep within the backwoods of rural Oklahoma, charismatic and musically gifted Amziah King, played by Matthew McConaughey, herds a bluegrass playing band of misfits while overseeing the premier honey-making operation in town. When Amziah's estranged foster daughter, brilliantly played by newcomer Angelina Looking Glass, unexpectedly returns, Amziah leaps at the possibility to renew connection and create a family business. But the honey game is ruthless, and Amziah's rivals threaten to destroy everything he's worked to build. Andrew made waves with his inventive and award-winning first feature, The Vast of Night, and with Rivals, he expands his keen eye for unique visual flair and keenly observed performances to bring audiences a thrilling, endearing, and wholly original caper. Listen now to our conversation, recorded during the Melbourne International Film Festival, where the film had its Australian premiere while in competition. I just keep thinking all the time and have all this week. It's a proud day for Blue Armadillo Propane.
It's a proud day for Blue Armadillo Propane.
My favorite line in the film, I think.
I think that came late.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was in the script, but it was definitely one of those, how can we, hopefully we get a giggle or a chuckle out of people.
Those few little audience pops, yeah.
Yeah, that have noticed we've built a small, every one of the brands in the movie is its own unique brand. There's never going to be like a McDonald's or a Coca-Cola. It's always going to be its own. I guess maybe there's a bottle of Coke or Dr. Pepper, but The restaurant's like Sad Abe's. And
I noticed that was the LLC as well for the company as well.
Idea. That was my idea to call it Sad Abe's LLC. Sad Abe's is a fake restaurant chain in a bunch of my scripts. So is
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
I guess I was going to ask like where the name came from.
A couple more. Good night. I could go back and forth. They're all over the place. The name Sad Abe's is complicated. I'll relay that one day, but it's kind of an inside joke. But I'm trying to remember some of the other things. Blue Armadillo is a brand we made up. There's a whole lot of those. And there's stuff that even will span scripts that I haven't written yet, hopefully. The hat that Colmar is wearing in this movie is a reference to a movie I have written and even has a little reference to the movie I made before this. So it's I always love to let stuff reappear and brands and things to reappear across scripts.
Well, I noticed there's so many little hidden Easter eggs and gems sort of inside Vast of Night as well, so that I'm happy to hear that's the same thing with this one.
Yeah, so they're more gems and Easter eggs towards future things that I'm creating, I guess, or want to make at some point.
Yeah.
If I'm so lucky to do. I don't ever take this for granted. You can make some noise.
Yeah, it's fine. Right.
I don't ever take this for granted. I don't ever think to myself, I'm going to get to make every movie I ever dreamed of. I'm always very thoughtful to go, what's the best one to make at this point in my life? What's the best one to follow up? The last one I did, and hopefully, you know.
Well, I mean, there's always the one quote I always go to whenever, like, thinking about directors and their filmographies or where they're going and what they choose to do. I believe it's a Francois Truffaut quote where he said, every filmmaker's current film is in direct conversation with their previous film, whether it be like in a direct dialogue or they're trying to do something completely different or shifting it around.
That's true here. I mean, I was doing the DI or the color correction on Vast of Night, and it was we spent, you know, let's see, that was a year after the Vast of Night wrapped. And I was color correcting the Vast of Night. I'd been editing the Vast of Night. I'd been doing music and this and that. I'd been in that dark movie for 15 months at that point, including production, 16 months. And all I wanted to do was crawl out of that darkness and be in the sun, right? And so Amziah came out of really just wanting to be in the sun for a production and, weirdly enough, for a movie in post-production where I – didn't have to work as hard to get the movie to the digital negative to show up. And I remember that was weird, but that was an overcorrection maybe. I just thought, how can I be in the fields of Oklahoma? How can I be under the sun? How can this thing feel completely different? And another way that it contrasted, it was conversation with The Vast of Night, was for me anyway, Vast of Night was real time. And it was, you know, it was a bunch of really long scenes, four or five really long scenes in Vast of Night. This one was like the first thing I ever wrote where I cut through time kind of crazily.
Yeah.
You know, this movie takes place over 6 months or 12 months. So those were two big ways that I would say the movie before this helped me shape what this one was.
Well, I guess like going back, like, I mean, if you're happy, I'd love to go back way sort of back. Yeah. What was the sort of thing that inspired you and wanted you to start making films, I guess? Like, I know you'd worked in movie theaters, and then, yeah, what kind of brought you into the production world of cinema and that spark, I guess, to get making things?
I loved movies growing up. Was a million miles away from it. Like, that was this is the thing I want always to iterate with people, reiterate and underline and bold and make his really shout it from the rooftops about my work and my career, my upbringing. Is I was just a middle of America, you know, was not a farm kid, was not a country kid, but kind of adjacent to that small community. But there were movie theaters around, and I didn't even get brought up on good cinema. I'm not even one of those people that I could say I was 4 years old when I saw To Kill a Mockingbird, or I was, you know. I mean, I remember my mom taking us out of school in 1989 when it was the 50th anniversary of Gone with the Wind. So that's interesting. Mm-hmm. So I had kind of a slightly a cinephile mother. I had a house that had a, at the end of the street, 500 feet away, had a dollar cinema that I could see from my front yard. Okay. So my, on Saturdays, my brother and sister and I could walk to a movie and put a dollar on the counter and get a dollar drink and a dollar whatever, you know, candy, and walk in and watch a rerun.
I was going to ask, like, so yeah. It was more a rep house, like playing the older films and stuff.
Yeah. Well, not a rep house. It was just second run in America, meaning the big theaters have run out of making any money off of it. Now we're into the second one. And I don't even know how that ever works internationally. So I hope, I don't know if that was something that was ever a thing, but it was in America. And that's how a lot of us saw good movies, was the second time around when it was out of a big expensive theater. And so I was very much, I wasn't baptized in the cinema so much as I just was around it, and there was not a whole lot else. Okay. There wasn't a whole lot of, I mean, there was sports, you know, there was football and this and that, but it didn't fill our lives up. It was just movies were around. So then I started to work in a movie theater around 16 years old, and I had started to sneak my way into better movies. I'd wait for my parents to leave town, and I would get an older friend to rent the movies of that era that were R-rated that I wasn't allowed to see. In particular, like these years I'm talking about were things like, not, you know, Fargo came out, Sling Blade came out, Pulp Fiction came out. These movies were, and then I started getting to where I was really interested in what was the, there was this difference and this gulf between the sort of family stuff I grew up watching and then all these great movies. And then I started just digging into things that were older, like Apocalypse Now and the movies of the 70s, the movies that were violent, the movies that, and it's not that I was, you know, Bonnie and Clyde, and I'm thinking about movies that my parents wouldn't have said no to, but they just weren't playing in our house. So those two things happened at the same time. I'd gotten into these movies, these older movies, the ones that we all kind of, that change our lives. And then at the same time, I started working in a movie theater. And within 3 months of working in a theater, I'd ask if I could start working as a projectionist. And I was working in a little screen that only had 8 theaters, which in America at the time, that was small. They were turning into 20 to 30 screens in the late 90s. And so I got to learn how to run film and actually project movies and put them on the screen. And I'd learn how to read performance schedules. I'd learn how to clean a projector at night. And so I was, once again, this is all a million miles away from Hollywood, but I was touching film every single night. And then I got to college and I learned the very basics of, here's what a white balance is on a camera. Here's what it is to, here's 3-point lighting, which is terrible, where you know, give someone a soft source on one side and a backlight and this. And I started to make small projects for the university I was at, for the community I lived in, and I poured blood, sweat, and tears into the smallest, most meaningless things that I would get paid $100 for, and I would spend them 60 hours a week creating it. Okay, so I was getting those shots up. I was learning how to do little things. And weirdly enough, I found out later that Genesis looked a lot like Robert Rodriguez, where I shot on video and learned the heavy lifting of what it was on a cheap medium and an available medium, or even a free medium for the most part. And then I would get to where, you know, within about a year and a half of having a camera, I tried to shoot my first feature. I didn't even really do a short film. I just went straight into a 2-hour thing. And it was all inspired by working in a movie theater and shot it in a movie theater, and then saw it after about 60 days of filming, which anybody that's made a movie knows 60 days is, that's the kind of schedule you'll have on a $100 million movie. Mm. I took 60 days out of my friend's life to make this thing.
Was that sort of like shooting on weekends and like after hours and things?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was after hours. It was definitely middle of the night. It was definitely on locations that we didn't have access to.
Mm-hmm.
And
I guess like borrowed time and borrowed locations. Like, yeah.
And yes, absolutely. And by the time, you know, by the time we reached day 59 or 60 or whatever, my crew had dwindled down to just one guy. Okay, so I've been through this, and I learned, I didn't pay attention to the hair on my actors, so their hair was, you know, growing out, and I never asked them to cut it, so there was just stuff that was never going to work.
Mm-hmm.
It was all stuff like that. You know, we would tape lights up on the ceiling, and they would fall in the middle of takes. It was a lot like that documentary American Movie. You know, it's brutal to watch whenever you're young and you...
If you've ever tried to make a film, that is like a horror show.
That was my American Movie. And also, it also reminded me a little bit of Ed Wood. I couldn't watch Ed Wood for years because I kept thinking to myself, I'm terrible and I just don't know it.
But that's what's the charming thing about Ed Wood is just the absolute enthusiasm and love for wanting to make stuff, which like comes through.
Well, I remember making this first movie, you know, and I remember watching Ed Wood that summer, and it was great, but it scared me to death because there's literally a point where Ed Wood is standing with a camera by himself outside of like Bela Lugosi's house, you know, and trying to get into. And that's kind of where I landed with that movie, is it was just me with a camera with like one other guy, and you know, eventually I realized it was not going to become the movie I wanted it to be. Fast forward a few years, I'd done a whole lot more work. I'd done a whole lot more. Commercials would be that's a pretty snazzy word for what I did. I actually mostly did corporate video, and I did anything in between. You know, I don't think I ever did a used car ad, but you know, close enough. But I was starting to get really good at other things. Like I did motion graphics. I worked very hard in places like After Effects and got really good at. Enough so that, like, on Vast of Night, for example, all the titles were things I was able to do. And,
was that just you tinkering around on your own, just having that interest and I'm wanting to kind of develop these skills? Or was it from specific jobs you were kind of...
It started with one specific job where the motion graphics guy bailed on the job with, like, 72 hours before we were supposed to deliver something to a client. And so I had to jump in and learn After Effects on the fly, and... It was like baptism by fire with that program.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got pretty good at it over the next decade to where I would say, you know, it was something that I was using specifically in the commercial world to differentiate myself. After Effects really was probably where I spent 90% of my time. Something could edit really quickly. You could edit a 3-minute piece with interviews and shots and stuff in about a day. Well, then the next 9 or 10 days was the graphics part. Mm. So that was interesting. I got good at that. And then as the years went on, I was still wanting to make a feature. I did another attempt. I took a stab at the feature that I'd done before, Send a Movie Theater. I did that again. And it was better. There's still an 85, 90-minute cut out there of it that I'll never show anybody.
Yep.
But it was shot on better cameras.
Still shooting sort of mini DV? Or
I had moved from mini DV to an intermediate format, pre-4K, but it was like a format called P2 on Panasonic cameras in the mid-aughts. And it looks pretty good, actually. I pulled it out recently. I was like, dang, that actually kind of held up. And then watched that cut and once again thought, I said this to somebody earlier, that thing took me 2.5 years or so before I had a cut that I liked. And by the time I got that far into it, I had already grown enough that I didn't think it was representative of my ability anymore. Okay. So then I by that point, I was doing big enough commercial work and stuff that I was able to get an early Red One, and one of the few people that had that. And then within a few years had kind of figured out that the key to really differentiating was going to be the screenwriting part. I had figured out kind of how to light, kind of how to shoot, kind of how to edit, and was doing well enough that was paying the bills and letting me kind of put money in surplus to end up being able to shoot my own movie when I chose to do it. And so I decided that the one thing that I had to do was learn how to write, and most importantly was learn how to write something that I could execute on the kind of budget that was going to be available to me.
Again, circling back to that Robert Rodriguez style thing of, yeah, with El Mariachi, he's like, I have a guitar and a turtle, let's do this.
I think I'd read his book by that point. I'd read his book maybe 5 to 10 years earlier, but it was my instinct without having read his book. Mm. It was my instinct was always to go out and do the thing. I still get in trouble in my marriage about this because I'll run into the kitchen and we'll start to cook something we've never cooked before and I'll make a huge mess and my wife will look at me kind of like, okay. And I'll say, well, a lot to learn, and she'll go, a lot to clean. And that's how bad I am about this. I'll start construction on something that I've never built before. I'll rip into things, but in fact, my sets are sometimes chaotic because I'll start running the shots before everyone's set, and it drives them crazy. Because I'm like, let's go. All right, camera's up, everybody. And what that does is it sort of lets us start to iron things out before we start wasting time and getting too precious with it. And that was sort of how I got into doing Vast of Night. Is one summer, this is 2015, I was tired of not having a feature that I thought was good enough. And I made a crash course to make a movie in 90 days. Now, this did not happen. Let me be very clear. I was going to go make The Vast of Night a lot smaller. I had imagined I could make it for $10,000. It was just going to be a girl and a switchboard, a guy and a... So rooms that we could just build very easily. I thought we could buy the antiques quickly and so on. And I wanted to write a script in 90 days. I'm sorry, write a script in 30 days, prep it for 30 days, shoot it for 15 days, edit it for 15 days, and then have a movie 3 months later. That was the goal. Because I still didn't have a movie that I thought was good enough. And I got interrupted on that process with the biggest commercial opportunity of my life, which was to work for my NBA team, which was the Oklahoma City Thunder. And they brought me an offer I couldn't refuse. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And I took them on, and I worked with them for 8 months. And by the time we got to the end of that, my budget had grown 70-fold from that early... I'm going to make this for $10,000.
Was that just through kind of developing and kind of growing with the project as you were kind of working on other things and having a gestate, or just...
The interesting thing is it never changed. It was always, let me put it this way. I was never going to make it for $10,000. I just used that as a weird, stupid metric to keep me from not being locked out of my own work. Okay. And I still do this to this day. I'm writing a script later this year that I'm going to use that metric with, just so that if I could only shoot for 10 days and could only use available things and borrow a bunch of people's time and then repay them if I ever sold the movie, no one could stop me from being creative. That's the thing I became addicted to in a way. So Vast of Night was supposed to be just sort of this crash course, get a movie made thing, and then it became a bigger and bigger opportunity to sort of actually utilize more of my skill sets, maybe, and it ended up basically gobbling up all of the funds that I earned for that job. And it ended up being a really smart move. But for about 2 years in there, before anybody wanted to distribute it or before it even got to a festival, I didn't know if I'd done the right thing. So it only changed in that I got to work with a lot better people. I got to hire a killer VFX team. I got to hire a very great DP that was way too good to be working for me. I got to hire excellent producers out of Texas, local producers, excellent production designers, people that took me super seriously, even though I'd never made a movie before. That's how that money got utilized.
Mm. And I suppose as well, like, yeah, having that, again, that skill set to grow and expand and things just pushes you even further. And it shows on camera with that film. It's a fantastic debut feature. If no one has seen it, well, I highly, highly recommend it. With that film, were you kind of going in wanting to kind of to be kind of as expressive as you possibly could with the camera, with all those insane long takes? And because I think it's the one scene of her at the switchboard, it's 9.5 minutes
yeah, you're
or something.
Right. Like, that's the answer is yes. I wanted that movie to be a series of, you know, longer directed details, but I wanted the story inside of the frame to be special enough that you wouldn't need it to be heavily cut. I had learned from these other two things I'd made in the past, I got real hung up in the edit. And by that, I mean, I would get real precious and I would have way too much material to make a movie. And then it would take me a while to cull it down. And so with Vast of Night, the goal was to try to give myself fewer options. I even explored before Vast of Night by a few years. I explored doing a single take movie that was practical. It wasn't going to be any digital. That hadn't happened yet. Nobody had started to take 6 or 10 takes or whatever and stitch them together. You know, this is, you know, years before that technology was available. So Vast was sort of a little bit of like, how can I limit my editing potential and just string together the shots? I usually only shot things from one angle, made sure I got it and moved on. And by the way that the production was set up, I couldn't do it any other way. There was no more time. We couldn't have moved lights around. I couldn't have covered it any other way. So I blocked it in advance. We hit our marks and we would move on. And some days we were doing 20 pages a day. Like your average movie, if you're lucky if you do 6 or 7. But, you know, when they're doing a long monologue, we did 20, 25 pages a day on some days. So that was as much the goal of trying to limit myself to where I didn't have so much material that I would never finish editing the movie again, as much as it was a practicality of how much we could spend on the movie. And also a way to challenge myself to be creative inside of single shots.
Mm, yeah. And I suppose, obviously, that film comes out, wins the award at Slamdance and things, Amazon acquires, and you're off to the races, I suppose. Yeah. At what kind of point around this time does Amziah start kind of bubbling in your mind?
Well,
brain,
it comes in between the point when you think it would and when... So I finish Vast of Night. Vast of Night's in the... It's being color corrected and posted, and like it's after we had a very weird thing in that no festival wanted to put Vast of Night into it. I could articulate why from my own perspective, but I won't do that today. But yeah. We didn't get in. And so what happens is I kind of write a script that I think I could go make if I needed to go work a job at a hardware store for a year and save up money and then go shoot it. That's what I did. I sort of decided, all right, well, I've got friends that own a beekeeping operation. We have a large Native American population here. I'd love to see something told from their point of view. And so it was actually before Vast of Night made it in the festivals that I wrote Amziah as a feature. And then Vast of Night comes out and surprises me, to say the least. And so I kind of pursued some other scripts, which I finished, and COVID hit, and I worked on Amziah for about 6 months to make it into a longer form thing. It was going to be a limited, but my heart wasn't in it as a limited. I was just sort of like biding my time because we didn't have theaters at the moment, and everybody was watching different things, and so I don't know. Everyone somehow takes that and thinks – everyone goes, this was a limited series. It really – it only existed as a limited series for me to have something to do in the writing process. And so after, almost as soon as it was, you know, 7 episodes, 360 pages, within a very short window of time, I truncated it right back down to being a movie and kept my favorite stuff from that longer form. And so it had multiple iterations, but this is how it became – the version that we actually went into production on.
And I suppose that's probably adds to that kind of novelistic quality to the film. Like, I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it really does feel like a great Southern novel, the way it kind of unfolds.
That's a huge compliment, because I love movies. This is a complicated one, because I don't necessarily think that novels always are the right shape for movies. I'm always sort of surprised sometimes when they try to do it, and everyone, and it even a great book sometimes doesn't become a great movie. And oftentimes it's like, well, this thing wasn't the shape of a movie to begin with, and then you have ones that defy the odds, like To Kill a Mockingbird, City of God comes to mind, and those ones are like, there's so much texture and beauty, and like, so I have some of my favorite movies that were books that turned into films, and it's sort of like, I like that idea, but I like it more as sort of a quality about the movie, if that makes sense. I'd rather always write an original screenplay than adapt a book.
Yeah.
And so essentially I would say that this thing was not ever a series. It was a 360-page script that I treated like I adapted as a novel. So if it feels like that, that's how it came about.
That's great. Yeah, no, that's wonderful to hear that's the sort of origins of it. And at what point, when you were kind of, I guess, in COVID, like working on truncating it down, did it kind of hit that point where you're like, this is going to be the next one? This is the one that I'm wanting to dive into, I guess, and kind of commit with.
Trying to remember the actual reason. So I had some more grand projects that I wanted to do and still plan to do, and it made the most sense to step up carefully and to have something that was closer to home and that I felt like I could have the most control over, because I think where you tend to see maybe errors in certain creative careers is people getting in over their heads and then not being able to pull off a second or third feature because the system conspired to where they weren't able to. So a little bit of it was just my own desire to hold on to the thing that I thought I could make happen closest to what I wanted to pull off. And I mean, the thing that kept drawing me back in against all odds was I just hadn't seen. I kept thinking, I kept hearing the music in this world, and I thought, no one's ever going to make that movie. No one's ever going to make that movie. I just thought to myself, that one element, just the fact that we're making this thing about real people in a real situation, and then there's this narrative music quality to it, kept making me think that's gonna be more unique than anything else you can do. And I believed that, and from what I can tell, that has been true for the people that get the movie. That is the thing that made it stand out. So weirdly enough, it was just what was in the bones of the movie that kept dragging me towards making it and making me think that this is going to be special if I can pull it all off.
Yeah, it's that great thing of like, I want to make the film that I want to see, that no one else can make or no one else.
That's what I tried. Yeah, that's what I tried. And in fact, I kind of talk about the fact that it's, if I've done my job right, I'm going to have overserved the audience for this. And that's what I want to do. I'm not going to make a movie for 10 out of 10 people. Like, if I make it for 8 out of 10, that's great. I'm happy. Like, that's amazing. But if there's two people that don't get it, or one person that just can't understand why the other 9 people, okay, well then I did something unique and bold and special, and I will always double down more on what you just said, which is make the movie I want to see. I luckily have the ability to do that, and I love that this is working for so many people, you know, because it's wild to me that I'm in Australia and a movie about the kinds of people I grew up with is connecting to the audiences here. Like that's the magic, I guess, of all of this. And I believe specificity about a subject and about a world and about a, you know, type of people will always hopefully connect.
That's it. If you like kind of imbue the characters, the setting and the, like everything with like that kind of honesty and that kind of truth behind it, people will see that and connect with it regardless of, you know, they're from the other side of the world or not. So, yeah. I'm just wondering, though, like, with that writing process for this narrative, is it something that you go into, like, having a, I know these are kind of the beats where I want to take the story, or do you try and surprise yourself with writing it? Like, I'm just going to sit down and see where this takes me and where these characters go.
I'm not that latter as a writer. I can tell you that much. I do structure movies heavily. This one was by far the quickest thing in the first draft that I'd ever put together. And it still was something that I outlined for, I don't even like the word outline. I structured it out. I don't believe in sort of, I don't write treatments. I don't even like the term outline, to be honest, in the film industry, because it's always still, I do what I call a roadmap where I list out big beats and I build a skeleton of what I think is going to play out and how it's going to play out, and then I go in and I surprise myself. And this one had very different things from draft one to what ends up being the final movie. You know, it went from 100 pages to 360 pages back down to 140 pages, so you could imagine that there's a lot more in the big one than there was in the final thing. But I do allow myself to be surprised, but I tend to know structurally what the big primal storytelling elements are before I ever start typing.
And, I mean, a big thing with Rivals of Amziah King is the kind of the different tones that the film ends up taking and the kind of narrative shifts that happen within the film. Does the having that roadmap that you were describing kind of help you to manage those tones as you're kind of going through, even beyond the writing process, even in pre-production, through production as well, having that kind of, like you said, perfect word, roadmap, I guess?
It is a roadmap. The thing that I think I'm very blessed to be able to do is I feel the movie as if it's, seeing it in my head is not a strong enough description. It's more like I'm feeling the future. I describe the narrative process for me as like, for a lot of people, writing a script is like you're going through it. And I only know this because other people told me. A lot of people are doing what you talk about sometimes, where they start writing something and then they hit a wall, or they hit a part of the, and they make a left turn, they make a right turn. That's great. That's like being in a maze. For me, writing is like being 40,000 feet over the top of a narrative. So I can see everything kind of from above, and I can feel how I'm going to craft the individual experiences and sort of dovetail them and feather them from one feeling into another. And then the other thing is I trust viewers to go along for things that I think they've been robbed of being able to go along for and experience. We could talk about many movies. I was talking about it tonight in the lobby with some people that were not challenging, but wondering how I knew I could maybe make some of this work. And by the way, not everyone will always agree with that, but I pointed out several movies that I thought were bold swings, you know, even Disney movies where I'm going, well, Bambi only makes it so far before the protagonist in that gets knocked out. Mufasa's the protagonist in Lion King before, So even kids and families can handle some, you know, traumatic stuff.
Well, even like in kind of inverse to that, like you brought up earlier, like Fargo, the protagonist of that film doesn't come in until 50 minutes into the film.
I've clocked that lately, actually, because I was trying, I'm doing some things with a script where I didn't know how long I could wait for my protagonist to come in. Could I do it on page 20? Could I do it on page 10? How far? And I want to say I looked it in. It's like, I'm going to get it wrong because I don't have it in front of me, but Marge Gunderson does not come in until like minute 37, 38, 39, 40.
Yeah, it's around that 40-minute mark. It's crazy. Uh-huh. And it's,
And I know there's even movies that are, you know, iconic like Star Wars, and it wasn't meant to be this way, but Luke Skywalker doesn't come in until 16 minutes and 54 seconds or something. Now, they weren't going to do that originally, but they figured it out. And so I actually trust viewers to have a little bit more they go with it a little bit better. And then I think our systems in the movie industry have sort of turned everything into the same shape, give or take. And I tend to try as hard as I can. If I feel that something is a shape, or if I feel like some, and this is everything, this is every line of dialogue. This is every turn of phrase, this is the way that somebody might block it this way, so I'm going to block it that way. It's not just to be contrarian, but it's to play with the rhythms of things and always be willing to challenge the way that the norms are playing out. And to be honest, I've only found that audiences, at least the people that know what I'm doing, get what I'm doing, go along for the ride.
And it, like, I suppose with the talking about those narrative shifts and things and those kind of, I lack of a better term, bold choices to make, is that something you kind of consciously want to play with, I guess? Like you're saying, challenge an audience with those, I guess.
It's I would be lying if I didn't say that is the goal to always be contrarian or like subversive? To some degree, yes. I mean, like but then the thing is, movies that are that subvert expectations tend to, over time, start to just, people come around to them and figure it out. Like, I mean, I'll give you an example of like one that comes to mind immediately, that nobody walked into the cinema and watched Zodiac when it came out. Who wants to watch a movie about a serial killer that the whole thing is about journalists, right? Yeah. And I adore that movie, but I was in cinemas that weekend. It was the movie 300 opened, and everyone went and watched that. And my point is, David Fincher subverted everyone's idea of what a serial killer movie was to the point where it just didn't make sense. It didn't make sense for people to go watch it, maybe? I had a friend that was a projectionist in that era, and he goes, he was starting that movie five times a day, and he goes, I just can't bring myself to watch that movie because every time I walk by the port glass, which is, he's like, it's just guys standing in rooms. And I'm like, yeah, but when you're in those rooms, they're amazing.
It's thrilling. Yeah.
Yeah. So to me, I think the reason I bring that up is it's like now that we're near 18 years removed from that movie, that thing doesn't feel that subversive.
No.
It doesn't feel like he broke, like it's just like we now know what a great movie that is and we go over to it. I think that, I remember, I mean, this I could go on and on, but I think that typically the great ones tend to do something that's a little bit, it takes a little bit of work for people to come over to. I mean, for crying out loud, just that year alone, No Country for Old Men has no music, right? That's subversive. That's different. That's trying something that, And sometimes people don't understand how they're supposed to feel unless there's some music telling them how to feel. I remember a review the day that There Will Be Blood came out. It was a DJ, local to Oklahoma City, talked about how the ending of this movie, I heard it's great, but the ending is just a total mess. And like, what were they thinking? Oh, my word. Talk about, like, I mean, that to me, that last 20 minutes is maybe the best set piece in the 20th century.
Yeah, but not just that, but it's in the title. It's there for you.
For sure, but I just think sometimes people want to really, they want to sort of bend you back into shape, into whatever it is. And I think I've just fallen in love with too many things that just don't fit the shape of the norms. And there was an interesting conversation about this movie in particular at the script level. Luckily, because I was really well represented and well covered with my team, I got a basically an incredible deal on this. And early on in the process, I got a pre-approved script, which meant this is what we're shooting. as in we're not going to go into this without me having, this is the script. But it didn't mean that everybody didn't have a whole lot of questions. And one of the biggest scenes that got picked and picked and picked apart was the school swarm sequence.
Ooh.
Right? Do you know what their big note was? It doesn't move the narrative.
Yeah. Right?
Okay? And once you hear it, you go, oh, okay. Okay, great. But the thing that I would point to was the Ride of the Valkyrie scene in Apocalypse Now, which does not move the narrative. You know what that does? It accomplishes them having a boat that goes from this point to this point, and it's just everything else in the middle is chaos to get it to that point. And I defended this school sequence till I was, you know, losing sleep at night from telling them. And it tends to be something that really connects with people.
Yeah.
And often the thing, even if it doesn't make sense to people, if you as a creative have a really strong feeling that it's going to be new in cinema, or is it going to change the relationship to the viewer and what they're experiencing, it's worth preserving and worth being different, regardless of whether or not people understand its narrative purpose. And when you watch the movie, you go, oh, but you learn about, you have characters come out of the woodwork that weren't really strongly featured up until now, and you see things in the Matthew character that's new, and you, it does teach you more about the world and even the value system, which is we're going to go into a place like this at all costs and save bees, even if it, you know, doesn't make sense on the page. And yeah, once everyone saw it, it tested it better than almost any scene in the movie, and nobody would touch it. Yeah, yeah.
Of course, because it is just that thing. Like you said, it might not drive the narrative story forward, but it's working so hard to help develop the characters,
yeah,
in particular with the audience.
It does. And I mean, and it changes your relationship, and it helps. If you, and by the way, if you take that out, you lose a bunch of the dynamic between the two leads of this movie.
Exactly.
You've kneecapped how much time they spend together, how they, the looks they have,
yeah,
minor moments that I think would all of a sudden her playing his game a little bit more.
Yes.
And so, you know, I understand that there are ways that the movie system makes movies better, but often they just kind of hang out and don't get it for a while until one day an audience, you know, watches it and laughs at the right times, mm-hmm, and jumps at the right times. And yeah, then they go, all right, good thing Andrew, you know, held to that, because now we know that it works. Mm. But it does help to have, I hope with some of these things going my way, that I'll have fewer questions on, yeah, some of these scripts, yeah, with these things that maybe on the surface, they are subversive enough, or they do push against the grain enough, or they are different enough that I make it often hard on the jobs of people whose job essentially is to rein in and make the thing a commercial endeavor. And I want these things to be seen widely. So you don't throw out everyone's notions, but at the same time, often their notions are to make things feel and look and sound more like something that already existed. And a real strong creative is to try something new. And so that's my mandate.
Mm. And well, speaking of strong creatives getting involved in the project, I'd be remiss getting this far into the conversation not bringing up Matthew.
Yeah.
When did he get involved in the project? Was it an early on stage? Or
No. We went through a number of actors and had some amazing options as far as who read the script and what they liked about it and so on. But it was at a point when I was almost about to leave this one and move on to another project that my team, meaning my agent and Matthew's agents, kind of conspired, and they worked to get him a script. He hadn't been working in a while, and Matthew was out of my league in every possible iteration of the thought. It was just like, no, he would never, why would he want to work with me? And so it was my team that met with Matthew's agents, who one of them shares a wall between the two offices. And I'd heard a year or two earlier, whenever I had this thing going around, that Matthew's agent had read it and said, well, this is something I think he would do, but he's not really doing anything right now. Once we knew that he was interested, they conspired. They got him the script on a Thursday. His wife was planning like a retreat for him, like, and he was going to be offline for a few days. So they all got on a call. They told Matthew, there's this talent, he's up north of you in Oklahoma, but you got to read this script. And he said okay. He read it over that weekend, and by the following Tuesday he and I were on a Zoom, and it went for 3 hours. And it was, you know, after about the first 15, 20 minutes of just sitting there looking at Matthew McConaughey on my screen, responding to things that I'd written, it became so natural for us to talk. And so now we didn't know any of the same people, but you know, we had grown up similarly. He's only a dozen years older than me. And I was a huge fan of his work already. Okay. So the big thing for me was trying to figure out a way to make him do something that I hadn't seen him do before, but also be aware that he was revered and beloved by many, many people in actually multiple, not just cinema, but in culture and in sports and in his book had touched a lot of people's lives. So my goal was to try to find a new thing to do with him, with this character, that wasn't just, that didn't feel like it was something you'd already seen, but also familiar enough that it wasn't alienating. And so he came on board in January. I want to say he agreed to do the movie within 5-6 days. It was very quick. We started having more conversations, and it culminated in us spending a while, a week or two in his house, where he kicked his family out, sent his wife away, sent his kids away, sent his mom away, and we just, you know, basically bunked up and hung out and pushed the script forward and found ways that we thought we could work together, found things that I wasn't going to budge on. You know, we read through it again and again and again. He paced his house like a madman, you know, pushing me on things, asking me if I was sure about certain things. He wanted me to justify some of my choices. And in the end, you know, we found the right tone for it. And that was 3 or 4 months process. And we went into it, and he became the guy that protected and made the movie with me, like he was always meant to be Amziah.
That's fantastic to hear, like having him there as well to help be so invested in the project and wanting to just help however he can. I can't imagine how great that must have felt. During that kind of process as well, are you working to kind of expand and build out the incredible supporting cast that you have in this film? It's a murderer's row of just amazing talent.
It was all during this process we were catching everybody else. Obviously, Angelina Looking Glass being the real catch here.
Yeah.
And we got the leading, and I don't even know at the time if anyone knew that she was the leading Native American casting director. She had done a few series and a couple of movies where she had found really strong Native American actors. And in fact, she was creating a market almost, because she was getting young indigenous people to start getting excited about being in movies and TV and theater. And she had sort of nudged Angelina a few years earlier, you know, from a tape or something, and said, "You have talent, young lady. You need to stick with this." And that was 2 to 3 years before we were even going out. So Angelique Midthunder ran our native casting process, got 200 plus auditions, I want to say that Angelina Looking Glass was in the third batch of the young ladies that sent in tapes. And so she ended up coming, doing an online after a self-tape where I directed her a little bit, and then we brought her into Birmingham where we were positioned. I worked with her for about 3 hours one day and really pushed her on some of those more emotional scenes, the bigger scenes. And then we called her back and had her read with Matthew. And that's how we got her and really challenged her. I think she would agree with that, but she sort of became Kateri as the movie went on. And in the meantime, everybody else I already knew Tony Revolori. I did meetings with him, and I basically just went out to him and said, "Do you want to play this character, Colmar, who's a banjo player that has, you know, an eventful night with Isaiah and then becomes integral into that gang." Yeah. And then Jake Horowitz, who plays Remick, was not, I didn't write the role for him, but I certainly believed he could do it. And he was available, and I advocated hard for him to the point where at some point the financier, as much as they were basically letting me cast anybody I wanted, they wanted to have a meeting about, you know, what I was thinking and why. And I explained it all to them, and they supported my choices.
Which is great to hear, because, I mean...
Yeah.
Oh, no, sorry.
No, and in that process, actually, they were the ones. It was Black Bear that came up with the idea for Rob Morgan to play Rippy.
Oh, okay.
I was barely familiar with Rob, but it was their idea, and I was like, let me see him. And I had a great meeting with him, and I was just like, this guy's unbelievable. And the cool thing is they were also basically the ones that nudged on making sure we got the right scale of actor to play, you know, our antagonist. And meaning they basically made sure we would nail and land somebody like Kurt Russell.
Hmm.
Because you could probably see how, you know, a lot of different actors could play the heavy or the bad guy, but they wanted somebody iconic, and they doubled down and helped that process go along. But then late in the game, we were trying to figure out who to have play Oat, who's our guy that, you know, shows up out of the fish fry place. And we had been talking to another actor that couldn't get a visa, you know, in time. And I'd had a call with Cole Sprouse a few years ago, and never really seen Cole Sprouse since the time he was in Big Daddy,
yeah,
as a toddler practically. And I just loved Cole, and we brought him out, and he memorized a dozen pages of dialogue and sat down and killed it. And then I would be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, Owen Teague, who is actually a movie star and a young leading man in his own right, you know, he had auditioned for a few other roles, and I liked him, but they were going to go to – they had already been cast with other people. I got a call one day from our casting director, and her name is Amy Coppin, and she says, Owen Teague plays fiddle. And I go, what? She was like, I just found out that Owen Teague is a violin player, and we've been looking for somebody to play this kind of silent role. And I called up Owen. I got on Zoom with him. I said, dude, I have this role that's all over this movie. It just doesn't look like it. It kind of looks like he only has a few lines. And he's like, man, I loved your first movie. I'll do whatever. Let me know. And he came down to Birmingham and plays all of our live music on stage, and continues to be one of my closest actor collaborators to this day. And then the last guy that I would say was sort of a Hail Mary, and not even a Hail Mary, he was just he worked out beautifully, was Bruce Davis, who plays our cop.
Oh, yes.
Plays our, okay, and the cool thing about him is he was a retired Oklahoma City police officer, and he got to be about 50 years old, and he retired from being a police officer, and he started to pursue acting. And one day he showed up in an audition for a commercial in the Oklahoma City area, and he said, I did a short film, and I did this monologue in it, can I read it? And I was like, sure. I was not interested, and he did it, and I stopped, and I was like, this guy's great. And, you know, he came out of Alabama and became this sort of sheriff type, and he brought a lot of authority to that role, because that's essentially, you know, he was in law enforcement for 30 years. So those are the people that ended up filling it out. I'm super grateful and very proud of the cast.
Yeah, like I said, it is just an amazing amount of talent. Yeah. Everyone is just come to play, and it's fantastic. Yeah. But, I mean, you mentioned Bruce there having, like, that kind of gravitas when he's on screen. In particular, the scenes between him and Angelina, it is just this amazing kind of power that both of them bring to those roles. Angelina in particular, was it something that you kind of went in with that mindset of, I want to have a very strong native character here, and someone that actually... you don't often see in films, I suppose, like actually having going, I guess, this kind of more badass, kind of independent, strong kind of native woman there. Because I know that's something that audiences, at least here in Melbourne, have been connecting with a bit.
Yeah, I would say there is a real danger in the badass thing, in that they can become that role, and it doesn't matter who it is or what movie it is, I think it can become kind of monotonous and not interesting, because you stop wondering if they're going to pull off what they're going to pull off. And I had a very interesting conversation with David, capital D-H, David Heyman, who's infamous for putting together the Harry Potter movies and the producer on Harry Potter and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Gravity. Some of the best movies of the century came from him, and he cast lots of young people. And he goes, Andrew, I'd love to know why you want Angelina, because she, I'm having a hard time understanding your thinking. And I said, because I think her journey is going to be more surprising and more interesting coming from her than anybody else that might be 5, 6, 7 years older than her, or that looks like they've already had a journey where we can already arrive at the conclusion of what's going to happen for them. And he said, I love that answer. I get it now. I'm totally with you. Thank you for explaining that. And Angelina, I think, does have a unique journey. And I haven't had anybody yet say that it's one that they didn't buy or feel like she didn't pull off. But I'm very careful about badass for anybody, male, female, anything in between, because I do think that that can, unfortunately, make the narrative kind of less surprising and less interesting.
Yeah.
But she does, you know, go on a journey that I think you don't expect, as David asked me when we were first talking about this. And so the question, the answer, I think, to did I want to show somebody from Native American culture, you know, be the lead in a movie and kind of end up being the protagonist and kind of take over? Absolutely. That was always in the narrative. And I think she did it better than anybody else in the world would have.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like you said, having that, having her in that role, you do have that journey that the character goes on, and it is that believability there. Like you said, it's fantastic. The other thing I need to bring up, of course, is the music. I'm sure that is what you get asked all the time.
I'm not tired of talking about it,
because it is some of the best music I've heard in a film in I don't know how long.
Well, I will just take that as a compliment to my curation, because it's not my music. It's music that found me, you know, and that I fell in love with going on, you know, some of these things 10, 12 years ago. It was trying to build something out that had a, that used music in a narrative way, that, that took it and filled scenes with a reason for the song to exist, or a reason, a dynamic to play out. And for it to, you know, have a similarity of sound, to where you watch a group of people gather and play music together. I didn't grow up where that was prevalent, but I did grow up in a kind of space where people sang together in four-part harmony and in any condition, anywhere, driving down the road, church together, holidays, when music was on the radio, when we were going to school, it didn't matter. And so the goal was to try to infuse that everywhere in this movie, so that you felt like it was just part of the fabric of this community. And then sort of the curation came in, to where it was like, okay, if each of these things has a narrative purpose, then I've got to integrate the right track each time. And they kind of came and went, you know, different time. Not much. Like, I would say the opening track, it was only ever that song.
Yep.
It was called Talk on Indolence by the Avery Brothers. That wasn't going anywhere. There's a track where they sort of like end up meeting at a music hall together, that's sort of a gypsy horn based kind of thing. That was always that track. There's the strongest one I think most people think of when they're thinking of this movie, is the scene in the kitchen where Angelina Kateri is drawn into sort of a impromptu session with Amziah. That one, that never was any song but Quill by Ben Hardesty, and the intro to that song, which is called Inheritance. It was always those two. There's a song when they're all gathered after they've like made some pastries and they're covering them in honey and eating very unhealthily, and you learn a little bit about Amaziah's backstory with Kateri, his foster daughter. That song bounced around. There was a couple of different options there, and a lot of people, that's hard to believe that one was anything but the one that it ended up being, and that one is called Sailor and Siren, and I didn't know that song until after I wrote the script for a few years, and then it fell in my lap. The movie gods told me, this is the one you're going to use. And, you know, the last song that's live in the movie that's played on screen is a scene that I wrote independent of music. I wrote a scene where there's one last gathering where our lead actress is sort of using music to hide in plain sight. And when I wrote that scene, I didn't know what song it was going to be. And I went trying to find a song. And it ended up calling my name out one day. I was listening to a band that I love called Shovels and Rope. And I put on their newest album at the time. And this song called Johnny Come Outside started. And I think I made it about 12 seconds into this song where I go, this is unbelievable. This is such a strong track. And of course, you know, we locked it in. And it was cool enough with that one that we actually got them to come out and play it on location. So a lot of the people that sing the songs originally on their albums and in their versions are participants in this movie. And so that was really neat to get to almost build a greatest hits and sort of a mix up my favorite artists in a way. And I love that people are connecting to it, because to be honest, this is a fringe pitch this time 3 years ago. This is like, I've written in the script that somebody hauls a drum into a kitchen and somebody has a fiddle and somebody starts tapping on their foot on the table, and then I write the lyric for a song. I mean, that is not compelling. You cannot tell people how it's going to feel. You can't explain how it's going to explode. You can't explain how it's going to fill the cinema or whatever, however you view the movie. I'm glad that I was trusted with it, because it would seem like in most situations that would be the first group of things you would cut. And yet here we are, and that is probably the defining characteristic of the movie. So I'm extraordinarily grateful that we're here talking about this rather than, you know, anything that would have been there in its absence.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, as you said, like that bringing the drum and bringing that sense of community into that kitchen and that warmth that happens with that scene, it really does just imbue between the characters, the music, everything there. It just builds this whole sense of absolute wholesome and the sense of hospitality that just runs through the entire film.
Yeah, I hope so.
It has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much
for taking some time out of your very busy schedule here to sit down and
love to do it. It may be later in the game when people hear it, but that'll be the first really long interview or podcast we've done for this.
Oh, fantastic. Well, it's been great. Thank you very much.
Take care, guys.
Thanks for listening to Madman Bonus Features, and a big thank you to Andrew Patterson for making the time to sit down and talk about his film with us. The Rivals of Amaziah King will be released in Australian cinemas on August 20th. You can find more information and where to watch the film via the Madman website or via the link in the episode description. Madman Bonus Features is produced by Liv McIver and produced and edited by Chris Swan. Additional production support from Ben Clay, Scott Tyler, and Michael Matrenza. Artwork by Mary Lynn. Madman Bonus Features is available wherever you listen to podcasts, so please share and subscribe, rate and review, and head over to madman.com.au to find more information on this film, The Rivals of Amaziah King, along with more upcoming exciting releases from Madman Entertainment, and be sure to follow us on social media.